Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Oh, Miles here.
Why, hello there, and welcome as Owlpost is freshly delivered for you this week. And I am just one of the hosts, Matthew Rushing, and with me, as she is always, the sunshine of my Harry Potter life, Drea Kaufman.
Hello!
Oh, that was very sunshiny. Like, you even did a motion. It was wonderful.
Yeah. You got a nice little wave on the internet, everyone, because you can totally see that.
Yep. And I can attest, everybody, Drea just waved at you.
There you are.
Feel the love. But so excited to be here today because this is the penultimate chapter of Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire that we're going to be talking about, The Parting of Ways. And I can't believe that we're here.
I wanted to give you a moment because I felt like that needed a dramatic pause following it.
Bum, bum, bum.
Does everyone get the gravity of the fact that we're basically through the fourth book? It's amazing.
It's insane. So just so everybody kind of has an idea, this show will end up having 200 episodes, and we will have gotten to episode 94 to end this book, which means that there are over 100 episodes still to come. Like, we still aren't even at the halfway point when we reach the Order of the Phoenix. That's how many chapters that come in those last three books as compared to the first four. So it just lets you know just how thorough she is with her story and that she still has a long way to go, which is very exciting. But we are almost at the halfway point. And if you're still with us, you know you can find the show all over the place. One is over on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, which is a great place to give us a review and a star rating to let people know what you think of the show. We're all over the place, though, now, because we're even on, like, Spotify, Stitcher, Spreaker. I mean, we're like...
That's super fancy, y'all.
Yeah, I know. You can find us anywhere, which... It's nice that those owls delivered our electronic mail to everyone. It's fantastic. Don't ask me how I trained electronic owls. It was tough. But you can also find us on Twitter at @JoinNerdParty, and we're also on Facebook at facebook.com/TheNerdParty. So places to follow us and like us. You can interact with us by using the hashtag owlpost. And then last but not least, we've got the website, thenerdparty.com, and the best part about that is you can also send us emails over there at thenerdparty.com/contact. You can choose a show, choose Owlpost, and then Drea and I get that email, and we'll get to talk to you. So, like we said, chapter 36 here of the Goblet of Fire. And I really enjoy the way this book deals with the character of Dumbledore. And what I thought was really interesting is from last chapter to this chapter, we get to see so many different sides of Dumbledore in the span of about, what would you say, there's this chapter and the next chapter probably maybe like a 5-hour span. And in that span, I think we get almost every mood from Dumbledore, except for maybe joy. Like, it's kind of incredible. And after they've gotten through the story with Barty Crouch, he gives some orders to Minerva and to Snape and asks them to do a couple of things for him, and he is going to take Harry to his office. And I just love the way that she even describes it, that, you know, he says Harry, and he says it gently. Like, there's just this... He has this way of being able to go from being kind of very intense to coming back to Harry, and just there's so much. I almost cried reading this chapter because of some of the ways that people treat Harry throughout this, and for good reasons. Like, just the care that they take care of this child with was phenomenal to read.
It was kind of like the first time he was taken care of. I mean, we've had people tend to him in the past, but this is sort of the first time you've got an actual sort of, like, nurturing situation where anybody who's been through anything traumatic or horrific or anything of that sort, they know that like Harry needs to go to sleep. Harry needs to relax. Like he's not going to accomplish anything. Like we know what it's like to like it's, they know that that's what's best for Harry. And this is the first time where they're like, we have to force you to take care of yourself because you're not doing it yourself. And that's usually your parents' job or something to that extent, which, you know, clearly the Dursleys were never nurturing to him. So this is kind of the first time he's actually parented by a little bit of everybody. And it's really a unique way to, you know, he's been tended to before. He's had a broken arm, but this is different. And I think I'm going to skip ahead in the chapter a little bit and just bring this up because it was my all-time favorite moment in the entire chapter. Was when Harry says that Mrs. Weasley hugged him, and it was a hug like he'd never had before, like one a mother would give him. I just loved that moment, and it broke my heart a little bit to think that he never has right. felt that, and that was really hard.
Yeah, I'm right there with you because I was reading that today, and on top of all of these other places where, you know, Dumbledore's caring for him, Sirius is caring for him. Spoiler alert, Sirius is back. We're about to get to him. But the way he's caring for him, and like, and everybody is trying to take care of this boy who has gone through the most horrendous thing that you could possibly go through, really. And yes, when you get that moment where he's hugging Mrs. Weasley and she's and the thought process is for Harry that he feels like he's going to break because all of this is coming out. Like the hug is in some ways finding a way to kind of squeeze out all this emotion from him that he doesn't even know what to do with. It's beautiful because throughout this chapter he really is struggling with. There is a part of him that doesn't kind of remember what happens. Then there's the part of him that remembers everything that happens, and he doesn't know how to deal with it. And there's this moment here where we get Dumbledore telling him, I want you to come up to my office first. We're going to talk. Sirius is there. So, I mean, it's this comforting thing like that Dumbledore has brought in the Godfather to kind of help Harry. And I love that Harry's question is not about himself. It's not about Sirius. It's not about anything. He says, where are Mr. and Mrs. Diggory? And it's a gorgeous moment because you see, again, like Harry, everything that happened to him, he's putting himself in the position of parents who have lost their child. And this is the moment, too, where Dumbledore, she even describes it, how he had been so calm throughout the interrogation. And this is the first time that his voice, there's some sort of shakiness to it. And he says, you know, they're with Professor Sprout. She's the head of that house. She knows him best. And you get that sense that there's the weight that's on Dumbledore here too. What's happened to Harry, what's happened to Cedric, what's happened at his school. You know, that this is not easy for him. And I really appreciate because I think what she is doing here, too, is she's building into something that she is going to bring out full force in book 7. And we'll get there when we'll talk about it then. But she is, I think, building a case for who Dumbledore is. And he's a very complicated person. but I think that you can see here very much that he cares about his students in a way that, you know, to him, there's a familialness to it, the way that he cares for his students. And of course, it goes even farther with Harry, but I really loved that moment that because it's a really small moment, but the fact that his voice is shaking a little bit as he talks about Cedric and where, you know, the Diggorys are, it's a really melancholy thing, but there's a real beauty to it because there's so much humanity happening in this chapter.
It also feeds into that guilt that he's experiencing a little bit, which kind of starts to percolate and come kind of boil over in this chapter. This, you know, he in the last chapter sort of started to express feelings of like it was his fault. And now he's like, oh, I got to take care of the Diggories because I'm feeling guilty. Like someone needs to take care of them. It's, you know, my responsibility to remember that. It comes up again later in the episode, like that he doesn't deserve the reward. It should go to the Diggories because he's the one who made Cedric grab the cup. And, you know, it just, this is, I think, again, going back into that a little bit, which when we start to talk more and more about Harry, we talked a little bit about it in some of the earlier books, but like that stark contrast between Voldemort and Harry having similar upbringings, but they become very different people. Him feeling guilt over just being a part of the circumstances that caused Cedric's death was, I mean, that's enough to make him, you know, completely guilt-ridden, whereas someone like Voldemort actually killed him. He feels no remorse whatsoever. Nor can he at this point.
No, he can't. There's this thing that happens too, is they get to Dumbledore's office. Sirius is there. Sirius is obviously worried. He's kind of like going into that almost parental rage of like, and I don't mean rage, but that thing like, what happened?
No,
I knew this
rage.
Was going to happen.
Okay.
You know, like, he's doing that thing though. And I think it's so good because again, it's important for Harry to have this in his life. And then there's this beautiful, again, we're going to keep saying the word beautiful, but there's this beautiful moment as Harry's sitting in front of Dumbledore's desk where Fox comes and lands on his knee. And there's this whole exchange that happens between him and Fox that I thought was just incredible. And it creates, again, this relationship that Harry has with Fox that we learn about. One, it's the core of both of their wands, which we learn about a little bit later of exactly why it happened, the connection between them. But we know now that Harry's wand is connected with Fox because that's the one of his tail feathers is in Harry's wand and it's in Voldemort's wand. And so too, though, Dumbledore says, I need you to talk about this tonight. If I thought that it would do you better to not talk about it and just go to sleep now, I would totally do that. But I don't think that that's what's best for you. I think it will help the most if you get it all out now. And
well, and not just help him, but he does allude to the fact that Harry could do good by it's important that if you've ever worked with anyone, again, who's experienced a traumatic event or witnessed a crime or been part of something, like getting it out sooner, you're less likely to have any sort of bias on it, or you're less likely to be swayed and be rationalizing it. Like just presenting facts as is what you saw as close to that event as possible is going to yield you the most information. And additionally, your mind to protect itself is not going to bury it, because a lot of those important details and thoughts get lost because we're trying to find a way to cope with such a traumatic event. So Dumbledore also knows that if he doesn't get it out of Harry now, it's possible he would never get it out of Harry. And that with something as big as the return of Voldemort, he knows that even if, you know, Harry has to go through this, that he, like, this could benefit millions versus just Harry.
And I love, too, because right on what you're saying, Dumbledore literally says that, you know, I know it's better for you to get this out because numbing the pain will only make it worse when you feel it. And, you know, that there's such truth in that, that burying things, once it finally comes back, it comes back with a vengeance.
Because you haven't processed it. You haven't talked it out. You haven't decided how you're going to feel and felt that and find a way to move past it, especially with guilt, right? Like it's just going to drive every decision you make and affect all facets of your life subconsciously or consciously until you figure out what you're going to do with it. That's why mental illnesses are so, you know, and I'll throw this in here with PTSD, like mental illnesses are so difficult to treat and they're so hard to identify and relate to if you've never experienced one yourself. And from our experience with Rowling, we know that she has, you know, a very intimate knowledge and familiarity with depression. So if you throw PTSD in there as well as something that she can kind of find relatable, you know, we're definitely trying to stay off any form of that that we can. And that's exactly what she's trying to do here. And it comes from a very like strong place of knowledge, which is, it makes it very masterfully done.
The whole, what I thought was really cool in this chapter was the importance of kind of talking about difficult things, you know, and that it is better to get them out instead of to hold on to them and to just let them simmer and fester and create what could be, like you were talking about, you know, when you just let those kind of things go, that's where you do get people who struggle with depression because they haven't dealt with things. When you get people, you know, you could create personality disorders in yourself because you're not dealing with things. Like there's so many things that go into this, and there's a real beauty of what she's doing here, which is saying it's, you need to talk about stuff, even if it's the most horrendous stuff that's ever happened to you. You need to talk with somebody about it because you need to get it out of you. And I really appreciate that.
In the same hand, she's saying, like, it's important for you to get it out. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's important to go through something to benefit others, right?
Yep.
You know,
yep.
It's important to share and to get those things off your chest, even if they're painful, because that can lead to the benefit of others. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes you got to suck it up and do it in order to, you know, truly be the good person in that sense. So it sucks, but you got to talk about it. So, as I say it with a laugh, I'm not meaning to like brush it off lightly, guys.
No, not at all. I think there's this point too, you know, Dumbledore, and I think everybody else in the chapter is doing a very good job. But I love the way he puts it to him. He says, look, you've shown bravery beyond anything I could ever expect of you. And I need you to demonstrate that courage one more time. I have to ask you what happened. And I love that at that moment where Dumbledore is finding a way to try and encourage Harry, Fox does the exact same thing by singing just one loud note, which gives Harry this feeling, is almost like that. She says it's like as a hot liquid had slipped down his throat into his stomach, warming him and giving him strength, like that it was the exact medicine that he needed. And that as he tells the story, he realizes that it's costing him everything, but that it actually is helping. And so there's this whole sense of that Dumbledore obviously knows what he's talking about, but that everybody is trying to put Harry in a place of comfort and protection so that he can do this thing. And I think that that's a real, I think a very important piece of this is, I think Rowling is showing that not only do you need to talk about things, but you need to do it in a place and with people that there is protection, that you are cared for, you know. And I think that's a real, you know, having been through therapy myself and knowing how important that is to have a secure place to be able to voice things that maybe nobody else will ever hear, is really important. I think she does a great job of showing how important that is in this chapter. And I really appreciate that for somebody who's been through depression and those kind of things. So I really think she does a good job with that.
This theme of protecting Harry, we haven't seen much of it so far. You get the idea that when they're very little and we're starting out in this and they're like 11, right? You get the idea that they're protected like you'd protect a normal 11-year-old, right? Like you'd protect an elementary school kid. That's pretty normal, y'all. But this idea of Harry specifically being sort of shrouded in this protection is really going to come into play in these future books. And she does a really, let's use the word of the day, we're just going to call this episode beautiful, a very beautiful way.
It's beautiful.
Of gently introducing that theme here, because like we kind of pointed out, this is sort of the first time where he's sort of handled and made to take a backseat in the situation way more so than he has before. And we're going to see more and more of this sort of like desire to protect Harry at all costs as we go through things that him, you are protecting Harry, not you're protecting a child. Like you are specifically protecting this individual. And this theme is going, it starts here with good reason and is going to sort of continue to play out. So I had forgotten that we sort of got that here. It's going to be really huge in the next book. So I thought that it was a nice segue as we continue on into the rest of the series.
For Harry too, you know, this is very difficult to tell the story because he, you know, he starts telling him about how he took his blood, and this is the moment where Dumbledore actually gets up and walks around to the his desk, looks at Harry's arm. The fact that, you know, that protection is gone. And I love that, you know, Dumbledore says, you know, that he's gotten over one protection, but there's this moment where Harry thinks he sees something like a gleam in Dumbledore's eyes that he can't quite understand, and that it disappears as Dumbledore gets back around his desk and then sits back in his chair and looks just as old and weary as he did before. But there's something there, and I think there she just plants this seed that's going to be very important for the end of the series here.
Him looking old and weary is also a seed being planted mm-hmm. here. We have a couple of things that, you know, we always say we're going to come back to these later. She drops sort of like, I like to think of them as she leaves little Easter eggs for her story throughout her other stories. And this is definitely, definitely one of those. Both the little smirk and glimmer of amusement in his eye, as you mentioned, as well as the fact that she kind of keeps pointing out that he looks much older and more worn down than Harry sort of ever experienced him. And we're just sort of getting started into this like crux of badness from a story perspective. So it's interesting that she also sort of paints that picture and leaves that little eggshell there for you. So another thing to sort of keep in mind and in the back of your brains there while you're continuing to read.
Well, and it's so interesting too, because she juxtaposes that with the whole, because we get it again here in this chapter where Harry sees in Dumbledore a power that he's never seen before. So there's this weariness, this oldness, but also this power that Harry's never seen anybody it with such radiated power, and he understands the that kind of like a character who has such cold fire that you there's nothing but, you know, like respect and awe for, you know, that's that kind of picture you get. So it's such an interesting juxtaposition, because we saw it in the last chapter there, we see it in this chapter here. But there's also this whole other side, and I think this is one of the places where we talk about at the very beginning. We're seeing all sides of Dumbledore finally. We're really starting to get into this character a bit more. Somebody who's been a bit more standoffish, but now is fully engaged, and we're beginning to kind of break down the wall of who he is a little bit, and that isn't a very important part of the whole rest of the story is Dumbledore. And so I really appreciate that she does such a good job of creating complex characters.
Yeah, for sure. And we go from this situation where he's nurturing and, you know, caring for Harry and what I always like to refer to as very like PC, right? Whenever someone says something that it makes Harry like super angry or worked up, somehow Dumbledore always has this sense of like zen about him. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, yes, I appreciate that. You know, kind of puts them in their place in this sort of like very calming PC kind of way that makes you like, oh, I can't wait till I grow up and learn how to do that. Because, I haven't learned that yet. But we go from that form of Dumbledore who's helping Harry get through this, not really reacting a lot to it, right? You know, he's like, oh, I'm so sorry you've had to go through this, Harry. Like, that sounds terrible, but not like, oh my gosh, this is horrible, you know, like isn't losing it. You're not really being able to read his response to the events that happened. You're only really getting his response to Harry's experience, right? Like he's focused on Harry. And then we move into the rest of this chapter where Harry ends up in the hospital wing and is sort of awoken when McGonagall and Fudge are arguing. in the hospital wing, which is a huge part of this chapter. This mm-hmm. is such a full chapter. Yeah. And this is that time where Dumbledore sort of drops that calming Zen level, and you see him sort of lose it. Like, at first, he gets it together by the end of the chapter, but definitely at first, like, he is not pulling his punches. He's not holding back. Mm-hmm. Like, he almost straight up calls Cornelius Fudge a fool. Like, he's not an insulting person. Like, he doesn't stoop to that sort of level. So the fact that even, I mean, like, the fact that he even goes there is means, like, you've severely pissed off Dumbledore. He is very PO'd, people.
I love that whole section because you really do get the sense that Dumbledore is done suffering fools, you know, because he knows what's happened. He understands. And I even love, you know, when Fudge is like, oh, how could you say he's back? And he's like, because I heard Harry's story, because I know everything that's happened this year, and I heard the confession of Barty Crouch Jr. on Veretti Serum, and you put all of that together, and everything makes sense perfectly. And so, I've got evidence on my side, which, so...
Snap. He, like, drops, yeah, Dumbledore drops the mic and walks away, or drops the wand and walks away.
Exactly, walks out. But I really appreciate that, but he also does it in a way where he says, look, I'm not here to be against you. I'm against Voldemort, and if we're both against Voldemort, then we're on the same side. You know, and what I also appreciate, too, is he says, look, Fudge, you're too enamored with your power. You're too enamored with what it means to be the Minister of Magic, and you're clouding your judgment. And you can either be...
I love, though, that he doesn't use power at first. He uses with your position. Yes. Mm-hmm. Like, with what your job and your role is, you're too in love with that role to make the right decision. And then after some time, he moves on to the true fact that he's talking about the power that Fudge has in that role and not the good yes. that Fudge can do in that role. Because yep. you can kind of take it either way at first. So I like that we sort of have to unravel the truth of what it is. And it's definitely something we'll come to learn later is a very mirror type moment for Dumbledore.
Well, and there's and it's interesting too, because she is playing with... history here, in the sense that basically what Dumbledore is saying is you can either be Neville Chamberlain or you can be Churchill. You got two choices here. Neville Chamberlain
yeah.
wanted to pretend like Hitler wasn't a problem, tried to appease him, and look what happened. Or you can be the person that people may look at as way too harsh now, but history will judge to be correct.
And at some point, kind of, who cares if history judges you as harsh, right? There are so many times that things happen, and you have to have just a little bit of faith that there are some form of information you don't know, right? So like with Churchill, like, yeah, he was still like a hugely aggressive guy. And maybe not the most pleasant person to work with or for or around, but he got the job done and he did what needed to happen. So, you know, not everything can be about sunshine and flowers and keeping, you know, Fudge is in this very political place. Oh, well, if I do that, then the politics of that are terrible. And you're like, who cares? Like, you're trying to prevent the equivalent of, you know, Wizarding War II or whatever. So, you know, what WW2, just like, you know, you were referring to the prime ministers before, but yeah, it's an interesting way to segue into, we've had so much history with Harry being in a physical form of peril, that this is sort of the first time he's being emotionally challenged, beyond the sort of orphan-y horrible upraising. You know, this is the first time where he's gonna have to fight something that you physically can't fight back, and it starts here in this chapter.
Well, and one of the things I think is really fascinating is that what he's saying is you can either do what is right or you can do what is easy. And
right
here, what is right is to do what is difficult, what is hard, what is going to be politically taxing,
unpopular.
Yeah. And I think yeah. that is one of the things that I love about the Harry Potter book so much, is that she is so clear in the morals of the series, and that there are things that are right, there are things that are wrong, and there are things that are easy, and there are things that are tough. And almost always what we see in Harry Potter, it's true to life, that usually what is right is what is difficult, you know? And
it's not easy. Yeah,
it's the harder road to choose, and it can be something that makes you less popular. And I feel like, you know, in a world obsessed with popularity, this is such a key message, especially politically. You know, when you see Fudge here, we laugh at him. We think he's just a joke. But I mean, look at politics from every spectrum. It's a joke. And it's because everybody wants to be popular and everybody wants to just, you know, win instead of do what's right.
Because everyone's trying to appease the majority instead of being true to what their beliefs are. I mean, it comes out all the time.
The beliefs just have a shifting sand with whatever is popular. And so, yeah, there's such a messed up thing here. And I think she's doing a great job of showing the foolishness of that through Fudge. And I hope we don't miss that in the series, because Fudge is an idiot. I hope we don't miss the fact that, well, too many times we're the idiots. We're more like the Fudges than we are, you know, the Dumbledores.
Yeah, Fudge is a great example of that just sort of over-politicized version of the truth, right? He has Barty Crouch Jr. dementorized. I can't think of a soul suck.
Yeah,
kissed. He has
demented. Yeah.
That just doesn't sound as drastic. Yeah. But he, you know, he has him completely removed from the picture before any sort of official anything can happen with him. Even though he's responsible for several murders, he just wants to sweep it all under the rug and pretend like he's just crazy and there's no way it was true, and then call Dumbledore and Harry crazy. And he just wants this whole thing to go away and to hide from the truth of what's happening. And so for him, he can't even seem to accept the reality of what's here in order to act upon it. So Dumbledore's right. He asks Fudge to send the Dementors away from Azkaban, because we learn that they are and were a huge proponent of Voldemort back in the day. And he asks him to send a parley to the Giants to make a kind of truce or sort of understanding with them as well, which again, we learn that they tend to side with Voldemort. And, you know, we find out both of these are wildly unpopular ideas. But so he's right in asking for these things. However, I will argue he's wrong in his way of asking, in that there was no way that was going to be effective, because Fudge is so clearly in fight and flight mode right now. He is not even accepting the premise of what you're saying. So there is no way you can convince him to do these actions, because you can't even convince him of your original premise. So I agree that these are things that need to happen, but Dumbledore couldn't get that buy-in originally, and therefore was never going to get him to do these things, which is, I think, the conclusion he sort of comes to when you see him sort of back off and be like, you know what? It's your call. You do whatever you feel like is right. I've told you what I think is right. You do you, man. You do you. But I think that the way it was definitely an emotional response and a smart reaction, but he definitely realized it was not effective the way he requested it.
Well, and I think the thing is too, like you said, you're getting to this point where Dumbledore is becoming more and more logical here. You know, he's not yelling. There's nothing he's very calm, and he's laying out these steps as to what you need to do. And Fudge is the one who's becoming more and more incoherent. And just like you said, he's in flight or fight mode, and he wants to fly. He just wants to get out of here. And
he wants to get away from everything that's happened, from them, from all of it.
And because he does not have the cojones to deal with the situation that he's been dealt. He doesn't have what it takes to rise to the occasion here. And it's disappointing to see that. But as you mentioned, Dumbledore, very much so, he says, look, you do what you're going to do. I'm going to do what I know is right. You're going to do whatever it is you do. You know, I love Dumbledore. You know, he's not being mean about it, but he's basically saying, look, if you don't do these things, you will, if you fail to act, history is going to remember you as the one who allowed Voldemort a second chance to destroy the entire world. That's just the facts. And so, yeah, you can go not do those things. Good luck with that, basically. I'm going to do what I know is right, which is those things I just told you. And as long as we're both against Voldemort, we're on the same side. I'm not here to work against you. I'm here to work against Voldemort. And I think that's such a key thing. And then I love, too, that Snape even backs him up. And he comes over in front of all of these people, you know, where he's finally admitting, look, yeah, I was a Death Eater. He pulls up his sleeve. He shows him the mark. He says, this is the reason that Karkaroff left, just went, you know, insane, crazy, and flew away tonight because he knew what was going on. Fudge is just, he is unwilling to listen to any reason because he thinks everybody's crazy. And just vindictively throws this bag of money on Harry's bed and is like, here's your winnings. Congratulations. And I just love how Harry wants nothing to do with that bag. Like, he's like, anybody take it. I don't want it. Cedric. It should have been Cedric's. The whole scene here is just disturbing and frustrating, and it makes you mad. But again, I think there's a real importance here. She is trying to show what happens when politics becomes something about popularity and power instead of serving the people.
She's also, I think, early on, that's his argument. And as you see more and more of Fudge and you see him start to sort of slowly lose it more and more, you know there is not a part of him that thinks every single person in that room is crazy. That's what he's saying. But you get the idea that he is so freaked out that that is what he has to tell himself to cope. Like, he's using this as a coping mechanism, right? Like, all of these facts and logic say that it's true, but he is so afraid of this inevitability of what is actually happening and of, based on like historical facts, he cannot actually accept it. It's not even a matter of wanting to. Yeah. He can't. Like, he physically, his brain is shut down and logic doesn't penetrate and he can't comprehend. And he is in this 100% defense mode. And like we mentioned, he just wants to get the heck out of there. And he wants this to just be a bad dream. And that's how he's going to operate. And that's how this whole next book is going to start. So it'll be really, really interesting to see that dichotomy of, it's not even a matter of Fudge being inept or dumb. It's a matter of him literally always acting from a place of fear.
Well, and what's really disgusting earlier is that this whole thing starts because Fudge is being complete turd because he's...
I was wondering what word you're going to use.
Because he, as everybody is talking about, you know, Voldemort being back in... Fudge is just smiling, and it comes out that he's taken everything that Rita Skeeter has been writing about Harry verbatim. Like, it's the truth. And so we're seeing that play in too. Bad journalism plus egotistical politician leads to desolation and destruction for the wizarding world as we know it. You know, like,
this is just bad news bears written all over it, y'all.
It's awful. So I did want to go back though to something that we didn't talk about, that, and it's the Priory Incantatum. And I think, you know, there was something really interesting in that, because it was another moment where Dumbledore is kind of taken aback, because it seemed, even though he knows what the magic is, it's not something that I think he's ever experienced, obviously. And it's something that's so rare to have happen. And there's that moment, too, where, you know, he has to tell Harry, you know, there's no spell that can reawaken the dead. That the people that came out of the wand are just echoes.
Yeah, and he's had to do that a few times with Harry. This is pointing that out again. You know, he did it with the Mirror of Erised.
Mm-hmm.
That you know, that is they are dead. That is a goal, a memory, a vision, a desire. That's not reality. Here he is, kind of telling him that same song and dance, like they were just manifestations of like what their characteristics were. They're not real. You can't bring them back. It's not going to happen again. I think trying to persuade him or dissuade him from trying to recreate those circumstances.
Well, and on top of that, with them talking about that, as they kind of finish the whole conversation there before Harry gets taken to the infirmary and Amanda Pomfrey, Harry realized that Fox has lost his knee and that he's leaned up against his leg and that he's crying on his leg and that his wounds are healed. And that, I think there's such a, there really is this whole sense of Harry being taken care of in every single way possible throughout this chapter. And one of them is that Dumbledore's, you know, closest friend and ally, honestly, I think of as Fox, that he is there nurturing Harry, caring for him in the way that he can. And for the second time in Harry's life, a wound that he has been healed by Fox. And it just, I think it's really beautiful. It creates this relationship between those two characters. And there's just something beautiful about the character of Fox. You know, a phoenix is the resurrection bird, and there's a lot of Christ similarities that go in with that, you know, and there's this beauty of Harry being healed in a magical way, like completely magical way, just, you know, through the tears of another. And there's something so touching about that that I really enjoy about this, that, you know, she does not forget about these little moments with all of these, you know, magical creatures. And we see that the magical creatures matter, because we see that later on in the chapter two, when Dumbledore is giving orders to everybody, he's asking, Molly to do things. He asks Bill to do things, about alerting people. He'll ask
a big ask of Sirius and Snape.
Yep, to put their bygones aside and at least be civil enough to work together, because they're on the same side now. But he asks, and this is something that it plays out throughout the entire book here, where we've been dealing with kind of the prejudices of the magical world. And he asks Madame Pomfrey to take care of Winky, to do what she can for her, and then take her down to the kitchens to allow Dobby to take care of her. And the fact that in all of the things that Dumbledore is asking people to do, all these really important things, that one of the things that we make sure to do is to take care of this house elf who has been so mistreated, and to do what we can for her to try and give her some kind of semblance of a good life here. I thought that was, there's a real beauty to that. That we're not forgetting the downtrodden, we're not forgetting the those that are looked down upon and that other people just kind of spit at. No, we're going to take care of them. And I think that's what we see. You know, Harry kind of attracts throughout the books these misfits, quote unquote misfits, right? And people that other people look down upon, but that become some of the best allies that we have throughout the series. And that's the same thing that Dumbledore was trying to do with, like, the giants. Like, we could parlay with them. We could get them at least to create a relationship with them so they won't join Voldemort, to extend our hand
and
friendship.
Let's at least make a good faith effort. Yeah, let's at least make a good faith effort to acknowledge them and their existence and their rights, so that when the time comes, they have a reason to not, like, revolt against us, right? Like, you're giving them a reason to not choose the other side. For me, the Fox moment, jumping back just a touch, I always read into that a little bit as well, that when you talk about therapy animals and mm-hmm. things, like they are able to sense pain and trauma that maybe a human can't pick up on, right? Like we and our social interactions can't feel. So the fact that for me, I almost had this moment of Fox is a therapy bird who is sensing this deep and instilled wound, both in his leg and in his soul for what just happened. And it's so strong that even Fox can feel and understand without having to speak English or know what happened, you know, that the bird is so attuned and his pain is so strong that he knows something is wrong and he is taking care of Harry. So I always thought that I always did the sort of therapy dog analogy to what happened there, and that, you know, even the animal knows something's wrong. It's like when you have a pet and you're not feeling well, the pet comes and like wants to snuggle with you because they know you're not feeling well, right? So it does just talk to that relationship you mentioned building between Fox and Harry, and it is just one more moment.
I think it also shows that the relationship between Dumbledore and Harry is special, and Fox, because he has the relationship he does with Dumbledore, transfers some of that to Harry. You know, again, right. You know, because the first time we met Fox was in the Chamber of Secrets, and he comes to Harry in his time of need because he proclaims loyalty to Dumbledore, you know, and Dumbledore tells him that only one who had showed me real true loyalty would have been able to call Fox to him. So we see that relationship, like you're saying, building. And again, there's such a greatness to what we're seeing, which is that people that are willing to do what is hard instead of what is easy are rewarded with true care by those around them, and that kind of family, that kind of respect and care for one another is what we get here. And you get moments like what we saw with Harry being hugged by Mrs. Weasley, and you know, it finding a way to help him overcome what he's going through. And I think that's really great. And the chapter, like you said, we end on a couple weird things and some difficult things as Snape and Severus are both given missions, which we're not quite sure what they're going to be yet, but they seem pretty dangerous. And then as Mrs. Weasley is hugging Harry, Hermione slams a window, which is kind of odd. And she's like, oh, I'm sorry, making this really loud noise. And they're like, she seems to be holding something in her hand. And then Harry drinks his potion and goes to sleep, and his chapter's over. So that's weird.
Yeah, that was a strange thing, and I don't remember that, and I have no idea what's going to happen, so I'm excited to see what's going to happen. But yeah, it was a very, very full chapter. A lot going on, and a lot of things to think about, and a lot of things to process going forward. So I think we have one more chapter left in the Goblet of Fire before we start Order of the Phoenix, so... I'm excited.
No, I'm right there with you. I really can't wait to begin this. You know, I do want to say, I think that what she's doing here is really smart. She, throughout this chapter, and she's actually laid the groundwork for about three or four story points that are going to happen in the next book specifically. And then that she's laying story points that she'll play out throughout the rest of the series here. And so she does a lot of work in these last two chapters. And I think, as you mentioned last week, it wasn't quite as successful as you wanted it to be. But I feel like this chapter, to me, is very successful. And especially...
Yeah, she definitely kind of rebounds here a little bit. It's like she had this chapter mapped out and before the last chapter mapped out and like... kind of got a little lost and was like, wait, I need something in the middle and I don't know what to do. So I'm just going to have them tell you everything because I really want to move on to the next chapter.
Well, and that's something, you know, it was funny because we actually talked even offline about last chapter and how there was a moment that we kind of maybe both forgot, which was that Harry's scar was hurting him so bad, he was having trouble seeing or focusing on anything, which made a little bit more sense as to why he wasn't as quick on the uptake, because he feels like he's going to vomit any moment. So I've been that sick before where you can't see straight and all your head is just spinning, and I've
been pregnant, yeah. So
you know exactly what that's like. I think that, you know, she, throughout all of this, what we were just seeing is that she had to bring so much to a close here, but she's also doing a fantastic job, because we do know what's going to happen, of actually setting up the puzzle pieces for the next few books, which is great.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah. I'm excited.
Oh, me too. I can't wait. This has been such a fun chapter. I think any chapter where Rowling makes both of us almost cry on air is probably a good one.
Going to say, what do you mean almost? Oh, on air. Oh, okay.
Well, I didn't want to give you away just in case, you know. Yeah. Sorry. No, hey. No, you don't be sorry. I came very close to shedding some tears in this episode. So just talking about what was going on with Harry, it still kind of gets me. But if anybody wants to find you, maybe just share their best, funniest Harry Potter gifts after this chapter. Where can they find you?
Right. If you want to come mock my tears or make me laugh, you can find me on Instagram at Drea Kaufman at COFFMAN or on Twitter at PCFChick.
And you can find me on Twitter, MattRushing02, and I'm on Instagram under the same name. I am also here on the network doing Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills, talking about Star Wars each and every week. I'm on the Trek FM network talking about The Orb with Chris Jones, and that's at the Deep Space Nine show. It's a lot of fun to do that. I do the General Geek show, as we talk about all the fandoms we love. It's called the 602 Club. In fact, it actually just turned 4 years old as of when, Dre and I are recording this today. So, and then you can also find me one more show called Cinema Stories. I do that with my friend Courtney, and we talk about films through the lens of faith. But as always, thank you so much for joining us.
Mischief managed.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.